Okay, well, without any further ado, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this evening. Larry, come on up.
My name is Larry and I'm an alcoholic. But I really did bring it. One of the things my sponsor taught me was that when you introduce yourself at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you start with your birthday. September 5th of 1985 was my first day of sobriety, and I had not found it necessary to go back out and pick up all the way through today, and I did not pick up today. I am a transplant here from South End of Seattle. That's where I sobered up, and excuse me. What it was like before 1985, so I graduated high school barely. There was 425 in my senior class, Seattle's a big town, and I graduated 420th. And I thought, yes, I know, yeah, can't take that away from me. And I then started to work as a janitor in the school district because they were hiring high school graduates, right, to be janitors in the school district. And the draft took me. So I remember that the way it was in Vietnam was they had once a year they had this lottery where they would take and assign a number to your birth date. And if your number was a low number, you were going to go to Vietnam. And if the number was a higher number, you weren't going to go, right? So I remember that night, and my number was 3. Right? No, I'm like, what? Wait a minute. And so, at that time, and this was 1971, and at that time, you had a few options, right? You could get drafted into the Army, go to Vietnam, and have a good old time, or you could refuse and go to jail. Go to prison, right? Or, Seattle's really close to Canada. You could just go to Canada and you would be fine. I couldn't do that. I came from a very civic-oriented family, and so I decided rather than joining the Army and going to Vietnam, I would volunteer in the Air Force, right? My first duty station in the Air Force was Quan Am Forward Air Base in Vietnam. I go, wait a minute, I wasn't supposed to come here. How did this happen? You know? So, Vietnam gets over, I come home, and everybody hated the war in Vietnam, and veterans were not welcomed home, right? So I got home, and I got back to my job at the school district, and they told me that they didn't have any work for me. And I go, no, I was drafted. You have to give me my job back, right? And they said, okay, go to this window down here, and I did. And they said, I handed them my paperwork. They stamped a bunch of stamps, handed me a piece of paperwork to go to the next window. And at the next window, they gave me 2 weeks' pay because they hired me and laid me off at the same time, right? And I went, oh, welcome home, Larry. You know? I crawled into a bottle because of stuff that had happened in Vietnam, but mostly because I'm an alcoholic. I crawled into a bottle for the next until 1985, and I got back in the early 70s, or I'm sorry, yeah, the early 70s, like 73, 74. I've had really horrible nightmares about what happened in Vietnam, and I couldn't stop them. I couldn't stop them. So, if I drank every day, I wouldn't have the nightmare. Something about alcohol, it stops you from remembering dreams, right? And so, 15 years at least in a bottle, I hit bottom a few times during that 15 years. What normal people would consider a bottom was not good enough for this guy. I got a job, and I worked for Metro Seattle, which was a bus company, right? The local bus driving routes around the city. And I was a big drunk, but no big deal. If anybody even said I smelled like booze, it was like, oh, some drunk guy on the bus spilled his wine on me. You know, no big deal. I was sitting in the parking lot of work, 1 foot in my car, 1 foot out, and I had just come out of a blackout. I was drunk, right? I was in my bus driving uniform. And I couldn't remember if I'd just gotten off a 12-hour shift or if I was supposed to start. I looked at my watch and it was 5 o'clock. No help, right? It was dark, 5 o'clock. And that was not my bottom. Turned on the radio, it was a nighttime DJ, so hey, I just got off work. I drove 12 hours in a blackout, taking people all around town, right? Don't remember a bit of it, but that was not my bottom. I didn't even think about quitting drinking. I thought about, I need a military watch, because it'll show me what, 1700 is different than 5 a.m. I got married. Had a baby. Little Christopher was not quite a year old. And I abandoned him. And I mean, I literally abandoned him. My wife was working. I was at home. I was getting the shakes. I didn't have any booze. Put pillows around this little guy and left. I was going to run down to the liquor store, grab a bottle, and run home. This still wasn't my bottom, but you would think, God, Larry. Running to the liquor store and getting a bottle wasn't as easy as I made it sound. I had to go to the 7-Eleven, get a thing of Budweiser, like a quart, drink it out back, shoot most of it up, but that would stop the shake so that I could get to the liquor store, get the bottle, get home. So I was gone at least half an hour. I got home, little Christopher, sleeping like a little baby inside those pillows. It didn't even dawn on me what I had done. Because Chris was okay. I was okay. I had a bottle. What could be bad? My wife, very quickly after that, fired me. So now I'm a divorce drunk. I'm about to hit my real bottom because it was closing in on September 5th, right? I am going over to my mom's house, my mom and dad's house. And it's the morning of September 5th, and I'm going over there because I'm broke, my dad's at work, and I'm not allowed in their house, but my mom will probably let me in, right, maybe, for a sandwich, something. I really thought I could maybe get a 20 from her, because that's really what I needed, was 20 bucks. And I walked up to the front of the house, and she waved me up to the porch. And I thought, oh, maybe it's $20 and a sandwich, right? This is not going to be so bad. She pulls me inside the house. I hear the door lock behind me. She hugs me in this vice grip and says, son, you're dying. I need to say goodbye. And when my mother told you something, you knew it was true, right? And I just stood there. Next thing I know, I'm on the outside of the door. It's locked behind me. I do not hear my mom crying in there, but she is, right? I learned later. So I remembered that day that if I died, I mean, if I drank, I would die. I believed that to be the truth. And I did not know what to do, except I had friends, a couple of friends that said anytime I wanted to be sober, I was welcome to stay in their basement. So I went over to their house, and I said, I want to take you up on that offer, and I want to stay in your basement, right? I went through detox in that basement. I didn't even know, it's 1985, I didn't even know that you could die from alcohol withdrawal, right? I mean, I had all kinds of hallucinations, puke and seizing. And when I finally got on my feet, I went to see a counselor, and his first words to me was, how ready are you? I said, I can't drink. I will die if I drink. And I don't want to die. And I had even a bigger reason, because I knew that if I died, I would go to hell. Right? I had broken those major commandments. And I knew that that's I was going to go to hell, right? So I told him, no, I'll do anything. I'll do anything. He pulls out this little schedule of AA meetings, right? And I go, whoa. Wait a minute. You're thinking I'm one of those AA guys. And I go, that's not me. And he goes, you just have to be willing to do anything. One meeting. Go to one meeting. I went to that meeting. Guy at that meeting told me to do 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, I said, okay, I'll do these things. So I'm going to meetings. It's my first year of sobriety. Life is better because I'm not drinking, but I'm not doing the steps. Okay? I'm at step zero. I'm sitting, no offense, in the back. Around the edge. I don't talk to anybody. I'm angry. I'm pissed because I can't drink. And that's the only stuff I had. That's the only medicine I had. And I couldn't live sober. And I got a job because you have to work, right? I have my son, Christopher, who even though I was divorced, I did get to see him. And I went over to visit him, and it was like my ninth month of being sober. And I went over to visit him, and his house was empty. My ex had taken him and ran, right? Like, I need this too, right? I'm trying to be sober here. You know, life sucks right now. And it took a couple of months for me to get a hold of her through some other friends and stuff and say, hey, I really would like to see my kid. And she says, he's not your kid. And I go, wait a minute, you know, you got pregnant when we were married, you know, and you had the baby, I was there at the birth, and you know, he's lying. And you're crazy. Crazy bitch. If you think, then I am not going to be a part of his life. So, next thing you know, we're doing the whole blood test stuff, right? Oh, God. I mean, I'm not praying because I know God's pissed at me, so I got to hide from him. God's been in my life this whole time, but I didn't know it then, right? So, anyway, I'm going, oh, God. We go and we do the blood work, and this is 1986, right? So the blood work's got to go to Boston, right? They got to hand carry it there, right? Bring it back. They don't just swab your cheek or anything. It's got to be a chain of evidence, right? So I'm getting my blood done after they did little Christopher's and my ex's, and I go, how long is this going to take? And I said, don't just give me some pad answer. I really, really need to know. Right? The amount we've been shipping off to Boston, about 20, 22 days, something like that, we'll get the results back. I said, great. That gives me enough time to set up my own death, right? Because I knew that if this child wasn't mine, that God would have taken away the only thing I have on this planet, and I was going to die. So, here was my big plan. Obviously, it didn't work. You can understand here. My big plan was, back then, we would take, as a medicine, Anabuse. And if you drank on Anabuse, you puked. So it was a way not to drink. And that was like on 500 milligrams a day, right? But I read about it, all I could read, like in the next week or so. And you could take like 5,000 milligrams a day. But if you took that much and you drank, you would die. I thought, oh, okay, so here, I'm not going to suicide, I'm just going to die a drunk. My family won't care, you know, or they'll care probably, maybe, but they won't be all, you know, worried about me dying that way. And I go to my doctor, he writes me the prescription for the Anabuse. I'm going to fill it like 3 or 4 days before that 20-day mark. A week before then, just when I get the prescription in my hand, my attorney calls and says, he's not your son. I want to know. No. Not so much that he wasn't my son, but so much that I couldn't die. God saved me, but I thought God was pissed at me. You know, it was like, here, I'll take your kid. You can't drink. Suffer. Just suffer. You're not going to die. You don't want to go to hell. Suffer. And that's what I thought God was screaming at me at that point. For the next year, I was the most angry, sober dude you've ever met. If you've been in a meeting and there's a guy that's so pissed off, and you can't even talk to him, he's just so pissed off, that was me. All the way till my second AA birthday. I had not worked steps. Come on, right? I'm just pissed at the world. I'm pissed at God. I'm still hiding from him. You know, thinking anonymous meeting was a good place to hide. And so, I'm 2 years sober. All I do is smoke cigarettes, drink coffee, go to work, go to meetings, go home, go to bed, smoke cigarettes, drink coffee. That's all I do, right? For that whole year, I was just pissed at the world. I would go to meetings just because I was lonely. And I had an afternoon, an evening job, like a swing shift. And it was in this warehouse that was along this one freeway that goes north and south, in and out of Seattle. Not the main freeway, it's a little side freeway. And it always backs up in traffic in the afternoon. So, it's all going to make sense. So, I'm at 2 years sober. I'm standing there because I just watched Oprah. And so this would have been, you know, 1987. Just watched Oprah. And she was talking about how little kids get abused, you know, like every fifth family has an abused kid in it, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, those sons of bitches. You know, I'm thinking about Christopher, who I still haven't seen. And I remember, I was so pissed. So I'm standing in the parking lot of work, getting ready to go in, smoking a cigarette, and the traffic's backed up on 167, a little side freeway. I'm going, 1, 2, 3, 4. You motherfucker. I'm not like this, right? But I was saying, I mean, I didn't say. And when I get to the fifth guy, right, I go, alright, I start through the field, because I'm going to go kick his ass, right? And I'm pointing at Daniel, and this guy's as big as Daniel in the car, but I don't notice it until I'm halfway across the little side road there. And I go, that's kind of pretty big guy, I think he's going to kick my ass, right? You know? I go, nothing. I turn back around and head back. And as I'm walking back toward work, it dawns on me. God, Christopher's okay. His mother loves him. He I'm sure has a roof over his head. He's got plenty of food to eat, you know. Take care of him, God. Take care of his mom. Take care of Chris. Take care of the family. And I walk into work. And I walk into work and I'm actually feeling pretty good. It's the first time I haven't been just so pissed off angry at the world. I just felt kind of good. And I walk into work. My boss says to me, we hired a new receptionist. She's up at the main office and she'll be down here in 4 days. Keep your hands off her, right? And I said, okay, but my first thought was, I bet I could get on her, you know? I'm feeling pretty good after a minute here. And 4 days later, I come into the office. It's my day off. Everybody meets me at the door of the office and they go, Larry, what are you doing here? You don't work today. What are you doing here? You better get out of here. And behind them, I hear the new receptionist and she says, hello, Larry. It's my ex. Oh. It's a miracle, right? God made sure she was okay. I just needed to let go and let him. So, Christopher and I, I've got to watch my time, I'm still good. Christopher, little Christopher and I want to get reacquainted. He doesn't remember me as his dad, right? And he knows who his biological dad is because there was all that court shit going on when I wasn't involved. And I want him and his mother to be able to sit in the same room with me and my mother and my dad. Now, my mom and my dad hate the woman. Hate her to all. I mean, she dared to have a man out of wedlock while she was married to me and make me believe he was my son, right? No, I was this horrible drunk. No doubt she found comfort elsewhere. I mean, I was this horrible drunk. And it was easy for me to forgive her. But right now, my mom and my dad, right? My whole family hate this woman. They love little Christopher, but he's been gone out of their lives. And so, we've all got to sit down and talk about this. Because I can't have Christopher feeling that anger, right? So, my dad is like the most awesomest guy in the world. He, when he retired, he started painting, right? But not like painting houses. He started painting portraits. Horrible, horrible painter. Horrible painter. After he died, I threw all his paintings away. They were just so horrible. But one of the paintings that he painted, and he proudly hung in the dining room of his home, to my mother's hatred, but was these, they were little 3x5 paintings, and there were 4 of them in a row, all with their own little, you know, things around the outside, and it was a dachshund, head, middle of body, tail, right? And he thought it was the greatest painting in the world, so he put it up in his living room. It's the one painting that I saved, because it is now in my garage. Little Christopher, the evil woman from hell, my ex, and the rest of my family are sitting around the table, and that's when it dawns on me, well, fuck, it's me. It's not my ex. It's not the cop. It's not my boss. It's not my parents. It's me. Because I could make anybody believe that this evil woman was the reason I got in so much trouble with alcohol, right? But no, it was me. And it dawned on me that day at the table, and water just came running out of my eyes. I just was crying so hard, just sobbing, sobbing, crying. And I'm trying to get my breath enough because I'm trying to look over at Chris. I don't want him to be hurt, right, in any way, and here's his best new buddy crying, and I grab a breath, and Christopher goes, That's one long doggy. That's about my cat's paintings on the wall. It's so awesome. It was so awesome. Christopher retired from the Navy this year. He got to know me really well. He got to watch me be sober. He's been to conventions with me. He's an amazing, amazing kid. Amazing, amazing. And he knows that I'm not. He knows everything about me. He knows that I was there when he was born. He saw the birth certificate that had my name on it, and he asked his mom, "What the hell is this? You know, who's this guy?" But Christopher's an awesome kid, and doing well, and doing well. You know, sobriety has been tough. Those first couple of years really tore me up. You know, I really wanted to die at the end of that second year. I still was pretty sure at that point, though, that God was pissed at me still. I did not want to do a second step because of that. Because if I turned my will over to the care of God as I understood him, I thought I would be hanging over a fire. Right? It wasn't until I learned there's something called grace. And grace, I heard the word and I knew, you know, give me the grace to live one day, and God gives us the grace to live one day and live one day at a time. And I knew all those things. And it got pointed out to me that the difference between me and anybody else in this room sitting at the table is the grace of God. We can swap seats easy. We can easily swap seats, right? But God's grace lets me stand up here with all the awesomeness of the world that I've been given. You know, if you stay sober long enough, you're going to see some wonderful, wonderful, wonderful things. Things that are so beautiful, I can't even describe them. You're also going to feel some pain. Really, really, really hard pain. The good news is you felt that kind of pain before and you're going to make it through. Life is hard. Life is hard. So, I get married in sobriety. You know, we're soulmates. until we get divorced, but so she had two little kids. Now the thing is, what I found out is that I cannot biologically have kids, right? So somehow I got the idea that God told me somehow that all of his kids are my kids. Right? Okay, so I can do that. I mean, I have a lot of children, a lot of grandchildren, a lot of great-grandchildren. You know, a lot. And those are all gifts from God to me. So, this wonderful woman that I married in AA, and she had two kids. Amanda, who was 7, Tony, who was 2, we stayed married for a while, like 10 years. She divorced me, left me the kids, right? Now, these are not my biological kids, but, you know, I've been a part of their life for a lot of life. And Amanda is this most awesomest, awesomest, awesomest girl. So she gets married soon after our divorce. She gets married to a guy in the Army. And they start having babies, right? And Mandy is like this baby-producing machine. And they're all girls. And they're all girls. 4 of them, like in a row. I got to be at every one of their births, right? And starting in Louisiana and then going to Germany and then back in Maryland for the 4th. So this is Mandy. This is how I don't even pretend. I'm looking at the ladies in the room, but I don't even pretend. But she would have a baby in like 10 minutes. Be like, I think, yeah, why don't we get over there? Because there's the baby, right? Just work these kids out. And so it's just amazing. So, my God, love her. Mandy is not alive today. I want to get that out because this is what happened. She got cancer after these four babies were born. And she fought it. She fought it so hard, I couldn't believe how much she fought cancer. And it was a breast cancer that metastasized, and when that happens, you just have time. Just time left, because it's probably going to win. She came home, they were all in Hawaii, at the Army base or wherever, and so she came home to Seattle. She died the day after Christmas, and this was like a bunch of years ago, but 1 month before that, I had a Harley Davidson, and she wanted to go for a ride on the Harley. And this little waif of a girl who, you know, cancer's killing her, and she goes, I need a real ride, Dad, a real, real ride. And so we had these little set of leathers, wrapped her in those, and wrapped her in a bigger set of leathers, got her on a motorcycle, and that was her goodbye to me. She was saying goodbye, Dad, you know. I love her so much. Her girls are now, you know, in their late teens and early 20s. They're the sweetest, most beautiful girls in the world. You know, Mandy dying was one of the biggest things I had to go through sober. And, you know, God showed me the way to get through this. He showed me ways to feel better. If I helped other people, I felt better. You know, and it's such the simplest thing in the world. You know, give it away to keep it. I believe that everything I've gone through in sobriety, the good and the bad, were all from my higher power. Because I chose to follow his path. The last few years so of sobriety and recovery, you know, I met a beautiful woman. I married her, and that's how I ended up down here. I married her. All of our together kids live down here in Santa Maria, and Orca, and Lombok. I had no idea this is where I was going to end up. My fantasies did not involve coming to Santa Maria at all, right? My fantasies had me in lots of other places, but God's fantasy had me here, and this is a beautiful, beautiful place. So, I still have time, because I ended up being diagnosed with small cell lung cancer, right? There's always a downside and an upside. So the downside is small cell lung cancer is really deadly stuff, right? They somehow, thank you God, caught it early enough, and so I'm cancer-free, so there's the end of that story. They had to do surgery, right? So they had to go in like three separate areas on my wall of my chest here, and go in, snip it up, glue my lung back together, and then slip out of there. The surgeon is this guy who's got this name, Palud Pahad or something like that, right? I remember sitting down with my wife going, we really have to listen to this guy because I'm afraid I'm not going to understand his accent. And he's from UCLA in LA. He's like, dude, here's what we're going to do. And I go, oh man. You know, whenever I bring my stuff into the room, I always get it wrong. When I let God bring it into the room, we always do it right. So they find out it's small cell lung cancer, and they go, okay, so surgery wasn't that good. We're going to do chemo. So they do chemo. I lose all of my hair, right? All over my head. And it slowly starts to grow back after chemo, right? And I'm getting this little bit of fuzz on the top of my head. And I went, yeah. And so I saw my doc, my cancer doc, and he goes, I go, what, And he's like, we probably need to do radiation. There's this thing called intracellular or cellular radiation. One of the side effects is you words afterwards. lost all my hair again. Completely bald again. Except it didn't, because they were only radiating the top of my skull. I didn't lose my beard. So my hair, who has the grayest hair in the room? My hair is gray, gray, gray. Right? Gray is like this hair, is my hair. It grew back 3 years ago, this color. I went to the radiation doc when it wasn't growing back, and I said, what the hell's going on? And she says, sometimes people's hair don't grow back. And I go, oh yeah, you could have told me that earlier, right? Because it wasn't growing back. And then I go see her a month later, and it's this color, and I go, now what? She goes, well, I never heard of it changing color, but I keep thinking, oh, the gray is going to come back. I know it isn't. It isn't. It's like, no, it's 3 years. Oh, my goodness, huh? You know, I found out that God really does love me. And I also found out that when I first got here, I knew every single one of you deserved another chance. You deserved another chance. You just did. Because my God, you're worth it, right? Not me. All of you did, not me, right? Now I know that I deserve it too. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous because AA is the one thing that I can count on. Always been here, it will always be here. You know, I want to make sure I didn't skip anything. So part of the radiation in my head gave me a cognitive deficit. I say my kids and my grandkids and my great grandkids' names every day, because it's so easy for me to forget, you know? And it's just, it's so crazy. I will get in the middle of a thought, like writing this down. Okay, here we go. I really love my life, you know? I don't know how to thank you. You all have given me my wildest dreams, you know? Alcoholics Anonymous is the most powerful organization I know. And I know that the one secret to AA is that we help others, you know? I worked at the university for a lot of years. And they did all this research and stuff. And so they did this research on why AA couldn't possibly work. Right? I go, wait a minute. Wait, okay, I want to see this stuff, right? And so they go, you have to help others to stay sober. I go, okay, I got that. I believe that to be true. when everyone gets up, somebody's got to drink.
Because you got to help them, right? And if everybody got help,
it's called a fatal flaw.
But the way I got it figured out, 36 years sober, I still need AA, so everybody's got to get 36 years. And then one of us has to go after it. Joke. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me here today, letting me talk. Carry on. I really appreciate it.